Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a episode focused on restorations and movies that haven't been screened in a while, looking their best. And for this edition, I'm glad to be talking with someone I've talked with about older movies in the past, and also specifically restorations that are circulating at the moment. And that is filmmaker James Vaughn. Hello.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for having me back again. Great to be here in New York.
Yes. I seem to remember one time I was talking to you, and I don't know, actually, maybe that was an interview, but there was a cacophony of birds in the background on your end.
Yes. Yeah, that was, I was in Darwin for 8 months or something, which is the northernmost capital of Australia. It's in the tropical part of the country that not too many people think of Australia as having that almost Southeast Asian tropical kind of climate, but I was living there for a while during COVID.
And now you're in New York, and you've been able to go to the New York Film Festival. And just to remind people, in case they don't remember, one project that you work on is a festival in Australia that specializes in, I guess, revivals and restorations, right?
That's right. Yeah. So it's extra interesting. I mean, I started working with the committee for Cinema Reborn, which is the name of the festival. It's a relatively young festival. We'll be having our seventh year next year. I joined that before I'd ever really gone to a festival that had a very strong revivals or restorations focus. And that same year that I joined, I went to Il Cinema Ritrovato in Bologna for the first time. And then again this year, which is obviously like a mecca for this kind of experience. And I guess revivals is a taste of something like that. I think Bologna has more than 150 or even 200 titles, and the festival itself and the Cinematheque that it's based around has a big role in restoring a lot of the films that they show, and a few here have come from Bologna. But it's super interesting, yeah, coming to another festival and just seeing how it's done and the balance in the programming. I guess most of my life I've been coming to film festivals as a movie lover and as a filmmaker, but now just a little bit thinking like a programmer as well, and also a writer, I guess, because I'm here also writing about revivals for Senses of Cinema. So it's funny kind of switching between different modes.
You've been here as a filmmaker, as you mentioned, and you're a veteran of the New Directors, New Film series. I don't know if that was the last time you were in New York, but...
This is my first time, actually. I had diplomatic troubles.
I forgot about it. We don't have to go into it. It was like a particular country that you'd been to, right, or something?
Yes, but I went to Iraq at the very end of the Friends and Strangers release, and Australia had a strangely strict travel ban and sort of obsession with a zero case baseline. So yeah, we were one of the last countries to allow people to actually leave. And it just so happened that the point at which we were allowed to leave the country was just before the very last in-person festival that Friends and Strangers was showing at. And it happened to be a festival in Kurdish Iraq, and they had invited me, and I'd already said no because I didn't think I'd be able to go. The possibility of going came up, and I went, and it was really amazing. But I just didn't realize that would cause me big problems getting into America.
Well, I'm sorry on behalf of this country.
No, not at all.
To begin with, it's hard to resist starting with what's probably, I mean, one of the highlights of the revival section this year. It's sort of an event screening in and of itself, inevitably, just because of the size of it. And that is La Rue from 1923. Abel Gance is the director. 426 minutes is the runtime, which, I mean, I don't mention only just as like a marathon, but because it really is a kind of monument. What can you tell us about La Rue? But to begin with, you went to see it in the theater at the festival.
Yeah, there were two sessions or two separate ways of seeing it that the festival arranged. And one was to see it all in one go with an intermission. And the other, I think, had it spread over 2 days. And I went to the session where it was all in one day thinking, oh, you know, I'll have the authentic experience. But in the introduction from Gina Teleroli, one of the programmers for revivals, she explained that the original presentation of the film was, I think it was on a weekday morning spread out over 4 weeks. I might have remembered that wrong, but all of a sudden I was kind of like, oh, why am I doing this? This is not real. This is kind of just pure masochism here. It's not even like an authentic way of watching it. But yeah, all in one go was a special kind of, yeah, way of experiencing a film. And I was certainly in my head counting the minutes at times to when I knew, you know, that the end of a certain chapter was coming, because it's an amazing film. But to see any silent film from 100 years ago, there's a sort of cerebral time traveling you have to do, I guess, to try and experience it like someone at that time would have been experiencing it. And with that in mind, it's an incredible film. And I mean, even without that, you know, as a spectacle, it's an amazing film. But there's certainly stretches that are repetitive, you know, and a bit wonky from what we're used to. As an extreme, I think, just in terms of pacing, it's very drawn out in terms of its plot. But then at the same time, it's extremely rapid at times too, like the montage. And that's what was really radical about it at the time was its really rapid montage and its splicing together of quite extraordinary sequences involving trains, railway yard. And it was set at a kind of a built set, but on location, one in an industrial landscape, but another in Mont Blanc. And so, yeah, visually, it's just amazing, like location shooting. For the time, I didn't even know it was technically possible. I really thought film productions were really bound to the studios. And yeah, I think it was quite innovative in that respect. But just a quick rundown of the story. It starts with we're introduced to an engineer who is presented to us like the greatest train engineer in France. And a train has just gone off the tracks and he's busy in this rapid montage saving innocent people and telling people what to do to avoid further catastrophe. There's another train coming. And shortly after that, he finds a child that seems to have been left behind, and there are a lot of deaths. So we take it that his mother has died, and he takes this child. And shortly after that, he decides to adopt the child. But there's a bit of, from the beginning, there's something strange about this guy, because soon after he's kind of destroying evidence that the mother was on the train just so that no one knows how he's got this child. And so there's a sort of strange sneakiness to him that pops up again pretty soon. We jump ahead in time. 15 years have gone past and he's now an alcoholic, drinking very heavily. His young son has grown up. And the adopted girl has grown up too, and they're the same age and they're very close to each other. But yeah, he seems to have gone off the rails with his career, and people at the work at his workplace don't know what's going on. It's revealed that he's in love with his adopted daughter. And not long after that, it becomes clear that his son is in love with his sister as well, although he doesn't really know it because he doesn't know the truth about her. And the rest of the film is sort of a series of escalations that come out of this Freudian Oedipal setup. But the imagery is extraordinary. It's extremely literary in that you're constantly interrupted between these montage sequences with quotations from texts that I guess was inspiring to Gantz at the time. And it's the commentary around the release of the film was very, very mixed. It was so radical in a lot of its formal choices, but it was heavily criticized by his contemporaries, film critics and other artists who were part of, I suppose, a burgeoning enthusiasm for cinema as a new art form with its own capabilities and potentialities. And he was seen to be stuck in the 19th century, I guess, with Victor Hugo and Rudyard Kipling quotations and being kind of very modern, at the same time romantic and for that period slightly conservative with his references, which is, yeah, super interesting because we still struggle with that, I think, with cinema in terms of defining what it is, and we still have these conversations in various ways. Film history has always been about pushing purely the material capabilities of the medium to an extreme. And yeah, through the 20th century, there's been debates about what pure cinema is and a rejection of a certain literary focus. To me, I think that's what's really fascinating about the film, is that it combines both somehow and set the medium on this sort of path, a forked road where it sort of went in both directions.
Yeah. Well, it's been interesting what I've seen of his work is that kind of a mixture of obviously, I guess, sort of a literary sensibility, but also an urge to use the spectacle of the medium to its utmost. I mean, I won't delude myself into thinking that people will mention this too much, but there's a Napoleon movie coming up this fall, and Avogadro's probably made the best known Napoleon movie before that, which had its whole saga of being reconstructed and whatnot.
Yeah.
And that kind of scale of ambition that he has seems to have been consistent. And I also always like mentioning that later in life, a collaborator or assistant of his was Nellie Kaplan, this French filmmaker, or made these kind of like surreal comedies. I don't know. I always thought that was kind of interesting.
All right.
I was really intrigued when I heard about the kind of rapid montage in a psychological way, you know, rather than what was coming up with the Soviet montage.
Yeah. I think he, before he started editing, I think he visited Griffith as well. And we don't have a record of what they spoke about, but I think that had an impact on him. It was after he'd shot the film, but before he'd started editing. And yeah, like you said, it sort of just sneaks in before Eisenstein's first film, I think. And is also, you know, happening around the same time as Stroheim's making these epics, Foolish Wives and Greed. So yeah, there's like an amazing amount of ambition and optimism in cinema at that point, and people arguing about which direction it should go, and huge formal innovations happening. And it made me think, you know, it's hard not to compare to some of the contemporary releases at the festival too, because I think, you know, cinema's in this endless process of rebirthing itself and reevaluating itself. And I couldn't help but draw a link to Agro Drift.
Oh, wow.
Which I really, actually really loved. As a film that is so interested in repetition, which is a huge thing, I think, in this LaRue too. I mean, scenes where we're getting the emotion of the character over and over and over again from different angles that sort of aren't really revealing too much. It's more of like a sensory immersion in the character's experience. The end of the film is like almost an hour of this like very slow reconciliation, which from a narrative point of view could be done really quick, but he's not interested in that. You know, he's really plunging us into saturating us in a feeling and a mood. And yeah, Agro Drift is like a one line idea. And there's an irony there in that film too, because it's funny, it's hilarious, but it's repetitive and it's about a feeling and it's about a formal experiment that pushes the medium in different directions that probably beyond what Harmony Korine is, you know, he's not totally in control of everything at this point. Apparently it's first in a series of 50 films or something in this totally new style. It's filmed on a heat camera. I don't know if you saw it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Like a sort of lightning bolt Martian sort of just, yeah, UFO kind of film. But I think that's what LaRue would have been, something like that at the time, I think.
That's such an interesting comparison. I mean, yeah, also because that, yeah, I totally see the link where that movie is also saturating you in a certain mood for so much of it. And this circling voiceover he has that just comes back. These almost mantra-like phrases that he keeps.
Yeah, yeah. It's also the colors too, because
oh, yeah,
the hand-painted splashes of color that totally dominate the frame when they're there, whether it's blue or green or red. And yeah, it's very similar with Agro Drift. It's like because it's shot on a thermal camera, you're just bathing in these colors the whole way through. And yeah, I don't know. Also the Human Surge 3 too, in another way, is just this really pushing cinema in a new and interesting direction. I love that film too. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh yeah. That film, it's almost like it returns to the freedom that you have in some of these silent cinemas where it's, in some respects, there are no rules and you can do more with the image. And one more thing that just came to mind, since you brought up connecting to newer films in the festival, The Sweet East. I don't know if you were able to catch
that. Yeah, I'm going to say, why I missed it, but it's not important.
It has a sequence that uses a kind of like an antique technique. It's named after Fritz Lang's cinematographer.
Oh, okay.
Where they actually shot a scene in such a way. I mean, it's the sort of thing where, you know, where like the backdrop feels like like a matte backdrop basically, and the figures are really tiny, and so thing that you would see in like a silent film, they mm-hmm. do for a sequence where two people are walking like in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. It's kind of incredible when it happens. It takes you back. That film also has kind of Griffith like inner titles.
I think I read something about, yeah, there being an inspiration with the casting, the naming of the character Lillian after Lillian Gish, I think.
So silent cinema is clearly at the vanguard again. And I'll do just a little plug here that, you know, we talked about a bunch of silent films. The first episode we did, yeah, it was great because you introduced me to a Pabst movie I didn't really know about, and Faust, which I think is actually experiencing a bit of a revival in the past year.
Mm, I think, yeah, there was a screening at the Light Industry or something. It was,
yeah. So that's all in connection with LaRue. Another movie in the revivals this year at New York Film Festival was also, you know, significant chunk of time, Abraham's Valley from 1993. And you pointed out that there's a connection, a bit of a through line.
LaRue wasn't an adaptation, but it had a very heavy literary influence. Gantz was sort of a magpie, taking quotations from authors, I guess, novelists and poets that he liked, and spreading them throughout the film in a way that rankled some of his contemporaries who saw him as a radical, but then didn't really approve of the way he was kind of keeping one foot in the 19th century, literary romanticism of the 19th century. Mm. And it's interesting because of that split, I guess, between cinema as something that is a hybrid art that is a combination of the other art forms versus cinema as in this sort of box of its own with its own formal qualities that should be looking inward at itself and its formal potentialities and what it can do. And I guess Manuel de Oliveira is really interesting filmmaker because he's always alienated people for being too literary. Was a common criticism. I think he's definitely having, I think this is the second year in a row that his films have been in revivals. It might have been Day of Despair last year. But I think his films really puzzled people because of their theatricality in the way that the actors present themselves and also in the staging, which often within scenes is quite static. And then, yeah, very, very literary, often with a narrator that speaks like a narrator in a novel, you know, with extended sections over a still image that just feel like someone is reading a passage out of a book. I think a lot of people have seen Oliveira as a sort of an antique, you know, of a different time. But there's so much in his work, maybe something like LaRue as well, or Gantz in general, where there's something very radical in his, and very cinematic in the way he constructs films too. I mean, the way he combines different elements is completely his own, you know, beautiful, very sensory. And I loved Abraham's Valley. I thought it was amazing. It's 3.5 hours. So another really long film, but it's based on a novel by someone that he collaborated with very regularly, a Portuguese writer, Agostina Bessa Luiz. They collaborated over, I think it was maybe 4 novels, a couple of plays, and you know, he was adapting her work. So they really, there was some kind of bond that they had.
I would just chime in with, you know, what you're saying about him. I mean, there's a way in which he's literary, but and there's also a way in which he is like a standing between dimensions kind of person. Mm-hmm. You know, if you watch something like Gabo in the Shadow or something like that, mm-hmm. or The Strange Case of Angelica, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the other thing that is probably important to mention with him is he was basically around when LaRue was made, a child, I guess. Like, he was making work in the end of the silent era. Maybe the only filmmaker whose career spans the silent to the digital era. For that reason as well, he's been considered someone who's stuck in the past in his work because of his most prolific period was from the 70s into the 2000s. So he was, you know, really old. The point when most people are retiring, this was when he the end of the dictatorship in Portugal. Yeah, he just had this really prolific explosion of inspiration. This film is an adaptation of this work by Agostina Bessa Luiz, but it's also loose adaptation. I mean, it very much resembles Madame Bovary. And I think there's a point where the character picks up the book and we have a close-up on Madame Bovary, the title. But yeah, the film starts with a young woman, very beautiful, who cars literally are crashing at one point early on when she's standing on the balcony. Yeah, there's a humor in Oliveira that's underappreciated as well, I think. It's just so many uncanny choices. I think you get set in a feeling of, oh, I know what's happening here. And then he makes a really strange and interesting formal choice. Like the transition from the young character to when she becomes a woman. Normally a filmmaker would, if they're going to do that, they would put text on screen and say 5 years later, or you know, the narrator would say, and then she graduated and, you know, blah, blah. And we get the new actor. But Oliveira's choice about how to make this transition is that there's a funeral and she's so overcome by grief. Narrator tells us this moment at the funeral changed her face. You know, it imbued her countenance with a melancholy that changed her forever. And then we have the new actor, Leonora Silveira.
Oh, yeah.
Who's in a lot of his films, sort of synonymous with his work. And then she, you know, appears after this moment. And it's such a strange but wonderful, wonderful moment of, yeah, this intensity in people's feelings that's side by side with a kind of repression too, because all of his characters are often educated, aristocratic. He himself is from an aristocratic family. Are you a fan of his work?
No, I am. And he's really a filmmaker that it's easy to take for granted, I think.
Some of his films, I just unwatchable almost, like because they're so weird. They're just so, they push into like just, I don't know, bad taste or something, where it just seems like he doesn't have control over the strangeness, but this one definitely worked for me.
Yeah, no, I have favorites and others less so. It's kind of impossible to like all of them, which is probably a good sign for a filmmaker in a way. Because it's,
yeah.
I mean, one other historical interesting thing about it is that there was a version of Madame Bovary just a couple of years before this with Isabelle Huppert that was like pretty famous. So I thought, you know, it's almost as if he saw that and he just wanted to explode it somehow with the help of this writer he works with. Abraham's Valley, that's something I hope to catch up with. And now I feel like I've been making you do heavy lifting. So I can talk about one film that I went to see at the festival. And that's Pressure from Horace Ove, who's a filmmaker who actually, people probably know, died, I guess, just a week or two before the festival started. And this is a premiere of the film's restoration that was done simultaneously with the London Film Festival. This is a movie set in London. Its focus is on West Indian community and centers on this teenager who is trying to find work, but keeps getting drawn into and interested by his brother's political involvement because he's looking for work, but he sees his brother's trying to make some sort of systemic change. So he's kind of an interesting figure to identify with. Over the course of the movie, you see him warming to the ideas of his brother while also retaining his own kind of critique of them, which is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is kind of the innocent or the naive guy starting out. And I mean, I don't want to reduce the film this way, but it really turns out to be like a handy way of picturing it and thinking about what it covers. The series that Steve McQueen made.
Oh, yeah.
That was released, I guess, mostly on Amazon or entirely on Amazon. This 5-part series that talks about this very period largely.
Didn't even know about this.
Yeah. I mean, it's the craziest thing that such a major work, really. I know not everyone's a fan of all of it, but that kind of period in the 70s, this clash, crackdowns by basically racist white police while there's this raising of political consciousness. And kind of an interesting figure also in this film is an American organizer who's joining the cause of these West Indian group. Mm-hmm. So, and yeah, in this kind of maelstrom is the young guy named Tony. Important thing about Tony is that he's British born. So he's born there, and that's a very different situation than his parents or even other people in the film. And his parents are very traditional, or their parents, him and his brother's parents, they're very traditional. They came to the country and just wanted to kind of keep their heads down and make a solid like living. Although even that, actually, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when the parents talk about how they feel and kind of come to a boiling point about their situation, which is a really fascinating scene, something I really haven't seen play out that way. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, it's a mix of professional and non-professional actors. I mean, the views you get of London are incredible. Just, yeah, it's almost hard to know where to begin. A lot of just ordinary, like daily life, you know, storefronts, a supermarket. There's a whole sequence that hinges upon trying to grab some cans of food from a supermarket into like an abandoned house or crossing like a bridge over a canal that feels very evocative, blinkered on either side. I think that this is the first feature-length drama by a Black British filmmaker. I guess he did documentaries before Pressure, including one on reggae. And there's a lot of great reggae and great music in Pressure as well. And I think even just like things that don't even feel like full songs, but these really kind of like raw beats that kind of come in here and there in a great way.
Mm.
The acting and the writing like can be a bit blunt, but, you know, on the other hand, the things going on are, you know, at one point they just have a meeting where they're having speeches and it's just, there's a police raid of this meeting and beating people and throwing people in jail. And there's this terrible confrontation where basically people are like, why are you doing this? You know, it's against the law. And this cop who reminds me exactly of like a cop in one of the McQueen films, he's like, the law doesn't apply.
Mm.
And I think it was good to see with an audience. I always like to talk about like the specific kind of experience of seeing a particular film with an audience. And in this case, people were just kind of like with it, like with every beat, kind of reacting along the way.
Mm, that's right.
Yeah, which actually makes me kind of curious with LaRue. I mean, what was...
Everyone comes out of it dazzled and and not sure, I think. I mean, the last hour was the people I was speaking to at the front of the cinema, kind of all in agreement. The last hour was particularly tough, even though there's some amazing images there in that final sequence. Yeah, the circle, the wheel, the iris of the camera is this... So much of the film is filmed in this iris. But yeah, at the end, there's this like amazing dance sequence where all the characters are like in a ring, basically holding arm to arm on Mont Blanc in the rolling mountains and the snow in the background. And beautiful, but totally by the end, I was like, I'm done. All right, I got it.
Yeah, I mean, Pressure. I'm sure this one's going to get a run.
Any other films that you saw that you...
Oh, generally? The Martin Reitman film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I actually did an interview with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was great. It was great. Because I, organized with Sensitive Cinema to do the coverage. And they just said, oh, you know, if you want to do an interview as well, we're always up for that. And there was just a moment where I was in the same room as him and was like, you know what? I love his early films. And I hadn't seen The Practice at that point, but I was like, do you want to do an interview? And he was really keen. He was lovely. He was super interesting. Yeah, it was great. It was kind of a rambling conversation. I haven't edited it yet, but it's the first thing like that I've done. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to read that. I didn't hear people talking about that movie, but it was definitely in line with his previous movies and his low-key deadpan comedy set in the world of basically yoga instructors.
Yeah.
And there's just something so funny about the application of his sensibility to that.
Yeah.
To this world that's supposed to like somehow make things easier and more relaxed, but they all are on these like simmering neurotic paths.
Totally. I talked to him about this because, yeah, all of his other characters, I guess, for the films that I've seen, they're always working really horrible jobs, you know, where their frustration with the world really makes sense logically, whereas they're in a space where it's meant to be in a peace and tranquility. But yeah, there's no escape from the Reitmanian pain everyone's in.
Yeah, the main guy is just this, he's a yoga instructor, but he's like separated from his wife, but she got the apartment. So he's like living where he does the yoga, but he's like falling apart. And his mom is like really, they have these great scenes where she's like gives him these stern talking to's. And he's always like, mama. And she's always like, mama, no. And then tells him what to do. She's like,
yeah,
don't mama me, basically. I don't know. It's great. And it's the title is La Practica.
The lead is really great, Esteban, yeah. Which I hadn't seen The Delinquents when I saw The Practice, but then I saw The Delinquents, and he's really great in both. And there's, I don't know what their relationship is, but there's some similarities too in that the comedy. And I really like both films.
Yeah.
A lot of good stuff coming out of Argentina.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, Reitman, he's always like this I mean, not so secret, but secret kind of influence, you know, like seems to make movies like not, you know, not like every other year. So I think Silvia Prieto, I think that was on MUBI recently. It might still be. That's definitely worth people. They want to start somewhere. I feel like that's a pretty good way to start.
Yeah, it's such a great film. I think he has, I think there's a bunch of his films on. His first film, Reparto, is also really great. And I think The Magic Gloves maybe is also on MUBI at the moment. So people should check him out.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess that would be my more New York Film Festival specific first viewing. Well, I think we might be able to bring things in for a landing there. I mean, there's definitely more revivals that we didn't get to. There's The Strangler. I'm sure there are some Paul Vecchiali heads out there. And this is a involuted or perverse kind of take on, I guess they're sort of comparing it to a giallo. But yeah, it's very interesting. The restoration is very bright.
Mm.
Do you want to just say a little bit about the Man Ray shorts?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love these films, the collection of, I think, four Man Ray shorts from 1923 to 29, maybe, which I also saw at Bologna this year. I think they might have actually had one session at Bologna at Il Cinema Ritrovato with a live accompaniment, which is more traditional generally, trying to take audiences into something approximate to what it might have been like at the time of the film's release. I think they had another session with the Jim Jarmusch soundtrack, which is what they also showed at New York Film Festival. Jim Jarmusch, and he plays music with someone else in an act called Squirrel. And so it was a pre-recorded, and I think they performed to these Man Ray films for a long time. He said in the Q&A, like long before the films had been restored even. And then it's, I guess it seemed like a perfect match. I was a little bit skeptical because sometimes these more contemporary musical scores can be a bit domineering and sort of irksome by the end of it. They just the gel isn't there, but it worked for me. I don't know. It could have also been that these films are so rich. It was something that Jim Jarmusch said in the Q&A that, you know, that he's seen them like 100 times because they've been playing to the films for so long. And there's still things that he picks up when he watches them. And I really felt like a completely different, I had a different experience of the films this time. The music is so powerful in how it shapes your experience of silent films always, but I think there's something in these films particularly, they're edited in such a intuitive and different way. They still feel very fresh and contemporary, and interesting to compare with LaRue, both using really new techniques at the time. But you know, people talk about Buñuel and Dalí's film as like the beginning of surrealism in cinema, or René Clair's Untracked that I think was like used in the interval in an opera. But yeah, these Man Ray films are amazingly innovative from around the same time, if not before. The Starfish was probably my favorite, the first one.
Oh, yeah.
It's a kind of romance between a man and a woman with this constant interruption of images of a starfish that are kind of like, you don't really know whether the starfish is something related to them, or it's like a metaphor, or it's just a poetic, purely visual, has a rhythmic function in the film. But the people are seen through this like frosted, I don't know if it's frosted or some kind of treated glass. We're looking at the couple, so we're never really seeing them very clearly. It's pure kind of free association, that the editing, in a way that feels like almost like a music video, the kind of image combinations that we're used to seeing in experimental films and, you know, music videos, I guess, as well. But just, you know, 100 years ago, it's like nothing else at the time.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there was always, I remember taking a like film course or film survey and having taught a film survey, there was usually like the same one or two Man Ray shorts that were available, and they were terrible quality. I mean, this is kind of in ancient times. So yeah, I can't wait to see these restorations, and also just to kind of expand what one knows of what he did. In this particular program, did it screen with this short, this Varda short of Pasolini?
Yeah, yep. Which was great as well.
Yeah. That's something I saw separately. And I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of comfort food.
Yeah.
It's like New York plus Pasolini plus Varda. But there was one thing that was incredible where I forget what her question is, but it's like, what do you notice most about New York? And he just says one word, poverty.
Poverty. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I was just like, wow.
I imagine that he, you know, intentionally wanted us to speculate on what kind of poverty to.
Mm, yeah. I don't know. I hope you had a good festival run. It sounds like you really made the most of the festival.
I tried to, yeah. Normally I would go to Sydney Film Festival or Melbourne International Film Festival and try and catch up on all the films that, you know, that are premiering and at the big Northern Hemisphere festivals, but I wasn't around this year. So this was kind of my chance to cram it all in, but it's been really great.
That's great. Just a reminder, you'll have a piece in Senses of Cinema and maybe an interview or two. So yeah, well, thanks for taking the time to go through the movies.
Thank you so much, Nick. What a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.